From the nation's capital, for National Public Radio, this is Josh Dorsa speaking to you from the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In a moment, the second program of the new fall series of national town meetings will be getting underway. The topic of this town meeting, appraising the Washington Press Corps. The principal speakers will be Ellie Abel, the former Washington correspondent and now dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism, and James Bellows, editor of the Washington Star. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished speakers from various fields, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the vital issues of the day. And now, the moderator of this national town meeting, Edwin Dale of the New York Times.
Welcome to National Town Meeting. Let me begin by saying, if any of you might possibly be a little confused about the subject matter, that Secretary of the Treasury Simon, who was to discuss the issue of controlling government spending, was unable to be here, and that is why our subject matter today. A second note, we've all decided that the term press should be construed in its broadest meaning, that is to include the broadcast media, radio and television, as well as written journalism, and keep that in mind when you have your questions or thoughts. I'll now give a brief introduction of the first speaker. Ellie Abel's an old friend of mine way back in 1959. It was that long ago that he left the New York Times, and I've seen him from time to time ever since. Former reporter, broadcaster, and presently dean of the very highly reputed Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He's perhaps most remembered to the general public from his years with NBC during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Ellie was just recalling covering the West Virginia primary in 1960, though that was prior to NBC, where he was, with NBC, a Washington correspondent, chief of the London Bureau from 1965 to 67, and Washington diplomatic correspondent in 67 to 69. Ellie was born in Montreal, graduated from McGill University, Columbia Journalism School in 1942, and began his career as a reporter in Canada for the Ontario Star. Ellie Abel.
Thank you, Ed. I'm delighted to be back in Washington. And I suppose everything I'm going to say ought to be discounted just a little by the fact that I was myself a Washington correspondent off and on for 15 years. Since Watergate, it seems to me, and I don't mean the hotel in which I spent the night, the press, and above all, the Washington correspondents, have lived in a somewhat artificial atmosphere of self-congratulation. From where I sit, I see the effect. We'll hold just a moment. The glorification of investigative reporting has filled a lot of young would-be journalists with very high ambitions. They are determined to turn over every rock and pebble in search of official skullduggery. And all this at a time when the media are having some of their own difficulties. We find schools of journalism and other training institutions turning out thousands of young heroes who have very few places to go. That is not, however, the crucial point that I want to make. When I begin to assess the performance of the Washington Press Corps, and I include broadcasting in that, and do it as a former Washington correspondent myself, going back to the Eisenhower era. That was a time when many Washington correspondents were said to have been too tame, too obedient to authority, too accepting of whatever officialdom declared to be the truth. There's something in that, though not, I believe, as much as surface appearances would suggest. It, in my judgment, simply is not true that the Washington Press Corps as a whole fed at the official trough and only at the official trough, even in those quiet years of the 50s and the 60s. It is true, in my judgment, that even then it was a small number of Washington correspondents who were willing to take the time and the sweat to endure official displeasure and, in some cases, official harassment. That did not begin with Woodward and Bernstein. Now, as a reader and a television viewer far removed from the scene, I have to submit that in my judgment, even today, it is the few rather than the multitude who carry on the battle, the adversary relationship that you and I hear and read so much about. It seems to me that now, almost as much as then, Washington correspondents suffer from the herd instinct. They play follow the leader. They deal in instant celebrity and instant villainy. They're not asking enough original questions. They're not burning the midnight oil sufficiently. And toiling over those tiresome volumes of congressional testimony that a great journalist called I.F. Stone mined with great success year after year to produce nuggets of pure gold. I've worked abroad a good bit, and I must submit to you that there are very few real secrets in Washington. This is a very talky town. Congress is a whispering gallery. Those enormous volumes of published testimony, if anyone will take the trouble to read them, contain a great deal of information that never does find its way into the newspapers. I would submit, and perhaps this is an unfashionable view, but it seems to me the plain truth, this is still the freest capital in the world and the easiest one for the press to work in. I say that even after living and working in London for a good many years. The British have a great many institutions that we all take pride in as part of our heritage, and yet you can't walk into the British Foreign Office or the Treasury and wander down the hall and break in on people the way you would do at the counterpart institutions here. It just isn't done. You cover Parliament, which is where the open discussion takes place, and the rest of the time you deal in announcements by government spokesmen. I would add that the things the press did badly 25 years ago, it still does badly in too many places. Economics, for example, which is Ed Dale's specialty, and I must say he's one of the few who does it outstandingly well. The intricacies of the world energy situation and what's ahead for all of us in terms of American standards of living. Something like the SALT negotiations, which simply defy understanding by most reporters. They're not prepared to understand it, and I'm not surprised, in consequence, that when I read what purports to be an account of what it is that we and the Russians have agreed to or disagreed over, they leave me behind. I don't understand what they're talking about. So it seems to me we still need better educated, more questioning Washington correspondents, and, if I may add, more humble Washington correspondents. Arrogance comes very easily to those who are assured of a block of space and time to address the rest of us. And I have long felt that the press, broadly defined to include broadcasting, and above all the Washington correspondents and columnists, would all profit from the occasional confession that they don't know, that honorable men can disagree on public issues, that frequently they must write in great haste, racing the clock, that they are human and they ought in consequence to be more ready than most of them seem to be to admit their errors and their shortcomings. Thank you.
I think one needs only to look at Jim Bellows' credentials to understand why the financially troubled Washington Star, as you all know, brought him here as the new editor of the Star. And some of the changes that he has brought about are now visible to all of us who read the Star. Since 1966, Mr. Bellows had been associate editor of the Los Angeles Times, and prior to that, he served as editor of the sadly now defunct New York Herald Tribune, where I began my work here in Washington. And there, among other things, he gave Jimmy Breslin his first break. Before that, in 1958, he began a three-year career as managing editor of the Miami News. And thus, Jim will bring the editor's point of view to our discussion today. Mr. Bellows was born in Detroit and graduated from Kenyon College in Ohio. Jim Bellows.
I've been here as editor of the Washington Star for only 9 months, so know that I bring you a good bit of perspective from both Los Angeles and New York, where I've spent the last 15 years. But here's how I sum up that perspective. Washington is the most powerful city in the world. It is also the media capital of the world. There are more reporters, commentators, and technical help here because this is also the most open city for media in the world. With Washington as a magnet, we also have the best and the brightest gathered here to report. They are the best educated of all reporters and the highest paid. And Washington, the city, has good TV and radio news and two good newspapers. New York used to be the place for budding journalists. Not any longer. Today, everybody wants to join the Washington Press Corps. We have more integrity here in the Press Corps, more talent here, and more competition here, all here to cover the most important news center in the world. Now, that all sounds good, but it does make for a clannish, incestuous press corps, too. Many reporters follow slavishly along and overcover the big stories and hope thereby to win respect and kudos from their colleagues. Very few stray from the packed journalism routine of covering the big public figures and the big public issues. And that kind of overexposure prevents a lot of very important news from seeing the light of day. Let's remember, this may be the most open media center in the world, but the tendency in any government is towards secrecy, and this one is no exception. With all the great and near great journalists in this town, it took two police reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, to bust one of the biggest stories in this century. And in the aftermath of Watergate, there's a malaise in the press, and the public is involved. Do you really want to know? Do you really want the press to do its job? I hope that's part of the reason we're gathered here today. We don't need a bigger press corps, that's for sure. We just need to approach the task in a more innovative, imaginative way. We certainly do the job better than ever today, but we have to. This is a far more difficult town to cover than when it was the pint-sized bureaucracy it was 50 years ago. But there's a lot more that we can do and should do to serve the public better. Thanks.
Now it's your turn to question our speakers. There are floor mics available in the far aisles, right and left. Please give your name, where you're from, and to whom you're addressing the question. And let me ask you, just for the sake of giving time to everyone, to try to keep your questions as brief and to the point as possible. To get things started, I think I'll ask the first question myself. I'll ask it of Ellie Abel. Ellie, did you imply in your opening remarks that as a consequence of the tremendous success story of Woodward and Bernstein in issue, situation, that there is now an excess of investigative journalism, that it's become a fad, that it's wasting resources?
Well, I wouldn't put it in terms of excess, but I think there's a lot of bad journalism that is masquerading as investigative journalism because it is the vogue. It is the thing that within the press people think they have to do.
Jim, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I just want to take it a little back because what I think the press is worried about today is that Woodward and Bernstein, and that's when we got into, in effect, making news, that the press was making news because they really broke that story. And I think the press really wonders now whether that's the right role. And, of course, I think it is, but I think we're going through some growing pains in the process.
I could mention two examples, not of the consequence of Watergate, that our own paper can take the credit for. Cy Hirsch's exposure of the CIA's involvement in domestic spying, and Bill Robbins's exposure of the grain handling scandal in New Orleans and elsewhere. I guess you both would regard those as useful journalistic contributions.
I most definitely would. They added greatly to public knowledge and understanding.
Now, anybody have a question? Please.
Yes. Now, Carlos Van Leer, journalism by telephone, using some of the world's worst poetry, to quote the August 30th
Star. Give your name, sir, if you will.
Carlos Van Leer.
Oh, I see. Right you are.
Mr. Bellows, when the Wall Street Journal says on page one that the Star is becoming a lot livelier, some of us feel like standing up and cheering. And Ellie Abel, last night the Star carried a Kilpatrick story on Rule 6. Don't take yourselves too darned seriously. Amen. In this spirit, I'm sending up to the panel members pages 283 through 287 of Conrad Lorenz On Aggression, How Humor and Satire Can Be Extraordinarily Helpful in Communication Between Us Humans. Now, three times recently, Mr. Bellows, I have made available to Star reporters tapes of news events, and each of the three times the Star reporters have worked very hard to transcribe and produce vivid and highly accurate.
I don't hear a question.
Just a moment. My question. You're right. I'm glad for your question. Can you spell out, Mr. Bellows, your thoughts on how citizens can best help a vital newspaper like the Star become as lively and vigorous as possible?
Well, we just appreciate any and all suggestions that, whether by phone or by mail or whatever, whether it's a story idea or whether it's some change in the paper, I think every newspaper feels the same way about that. Or at least I hope so.
How about letters to the editor, Jim?
Well, letters to the editor the same way, and especially when somebody really wants to take the time to really do some research on their own on some subject and write a longer piece, which is what the New York Times is doing on their opposite editorial page, and both the Post and the Star try to do on their pages along with the editorial pages in the Daily and in the Sunday.
Let me just add that I, too, read Kilpatrick in the Star last night, and I thought it was one of his better columns.
I'll intersperse the oral and the written. Oh, yes, this is a perfectly legitimate question, although the beginning of it is a little off-putting. The other day, I saw an outstanding journalist, Peter Lizagor, who is from the Chicago Daily News and been here for many years, pictured, obviously, hugely enjoying himself at an embassy party. Do you believe participation at such affairs might possibly influence a reporter's objectivity? A long-standing question, and I'll ask Ellie Abel first.
I think it's conceivable that a reporter might be taken in by getting invited to a dinner or a cocktail party, but I have never known one who was. It seems to me a rather academic point, particularly in the case of Peter Lizagor.
You wish to say anything, Jim?
Yeah, I sort of disagree a little bit with that. I leave Peter Lizagor aside, if you will. But I just think it's important to somehow have a little arm's length between reporters and the people that they are covering day by day. I don't mean that you shouldn't avoid having a cup of coffee or whatever else, but I think it can go too far, and I think that's part of the problem, let's say, in where we cover a little more of all newspapers, a little more of the jet set activities that go on in the world rather than where people are really living out there. And I don't think that the people in the suburbs really can relate or understand quite that situation. And I think that has to do with over coverage of Georgetown, say, in Washington.
Ah, well, that seems to me a problem of the editor's decision about what makes news. I would agree with you that the fact that Pete Lizagor was having a drink at an embassy is not news. But the Washington newspapers have made it news ever since I know this town.
I'll take a brief crack at that when I go to an occasional embassy party, too, or dinner party, and regard them as very frequently awfully useful for getting information. People are informal and they'll talk freely. I don't think there's really a problem with being taken in by a viewpoint. That's just my view. To Jim Bellows to start with, at what point should a journalist hold off or filter information of a sensitive nature that he receives from the government?
Well, are we talking about something like the Glomar situation, the Glomar subcase?
I'm not sure what the questioner had in mind. That, in case you don't know, is the issue where...
This goes all the way back to the Bay of Pigs and everything else, and I think there's a real problem here that newspapers have got to face as more and more newspapers have become bigger, more powerful. In effect, they are becoming part of the establishment. And that really isn't the job of newspapers. The job of the first responsibility of the newspapers is to the public. And if there is something that they think is important to be published because it could be helpful to the citizens in the country, I think they should publish it. If it turned out in the end to possibly be harmful to the country, they would have to bear the consequences. But let's say that it was turned out to be very beneficial to publish that. I think that newspapers, too many of them now in powerful positions, are holding back on things until there's almost a consortium of newspapers that get together and say, well, okay, we'll publish that now because somebody else is about to break the story, and that shouldn't be the guideline.
You any thoughts, Ellie?
Yeah, I would agree, although I do think there is less of that kind of holding back now than there was, say, 20 years ago.
I would concur in that. I think you're faced here with a rather exceptional cases, such as the Glomar, that underwater exploring ship, which several newspaper men knew about and sort of jointly agreed not to publish. I wouldn't count that as a common experience. Anybody on his feet? His or her feet? All right. I have a little trouble seeing. Over there? Will the mic proceed?
Right here.
Yes.
I'd like to state that my name is Edgar Bearrunner, and I'm a member of the independent Oglala Nation in the state of South Dakota. I'm here in Washington, D.C., as a delegation member of the Treaty Council. One of the questions I have for you is why, since we've been here, we've come here to Washington, D.C. about 2.5 weeks ago, and I am wondering why the mass media or the general media, however is defined, is not covering the truth or the story of the Native American.
All right, Jim Bellows should answer that. I guess we're all clear that this is the American Indian movement.
I really couldn't answer that. I can't figure out why it hasn't been covered. In other words,
Sorry, excuse me, did I get that wrong?
I'd like to interfere I did not say I am a member of the American in the Movement. I am a member of the Oglala Band of the Sioux Nation.
Of the Sioux Nation. My fault. I apologize. Go ahead, Jim.
I don't know exactly why that hasn't been covered, but I would think that if you have some special case to be presented, that it would certainly be covered by one of the two newspapers in this town if it was something that affected the people in this area or the people in this country, and it was newsworthy.
I would like to say this. We have called 5 press conferences, invited national news, NBC, ABC, AP, UPI. As I said before, we are a treaty delegation of this independent Oglala Nation. We have sent a letter to the president in regards to our treaty made with this government in 1868.
Okay, well, if you'll call my office this afternoon, I'll talk to you about it, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll start this one with Ellie Abel. How does Jack Anderson's style of investigative reporting affect the other journalists in Washington?
Well, Jack's style is his own, but I would submit that when Jack comes up with a real nugget of information that others have not discovered for themselves, the others follow up very quickly, and I can think of several examples in the last few weeks. Jack and his associates do a very aggressive job, and they have excellent sources in a wide variety of places in this capital, and they set the pace frequently in the area of investigative reporting for the rest of the press corps.
Jim, any thoughts?
Well, I think it's a generally healthy thing. The more people that we have working different places on different stories, the better off we're going to be. And the more publications and the more reporters.
I'll make a personal comment on that, although I'm in no sense in the investigative reporting side of things. There is also the problem that Jack Anderson's stories aren't always right. Anybody? Yes?
My name is Jim Cummins. I'm a graduate student in journalism at American University. You gentlemen spoke of PAC journalism, and probably the most famous PAC of journalists in the town is the White House Press Corps. What I wanted to ask both of you to comment on is the point that was raised by Timothy Krause in his book, The Boys on the Bus, and that is that the White House Press Corps has two tendencies as far as the PAC goes. One is to be cooperative, maybe to an extreme, to go with the same leads rather than to, you know, go with individual instincts. And then on the other hand, to not cooperate where it would be really helpful to the American public, which is in the area of asking good follow-up questions during press conferences and so forth. Tend to be too individualistic during press conferences and to let important points slip by after a comment that is not really adequate. Do you have any comments on the White House Press Corps in general?
Oh, well, let me try that. I was never a White House correspondent, I'm glad to say, but I watched their work over a long period of time. I don't think Timothy Krause or perhaps the questioner have taken fully into account the problem of the White House correspondent, whether for a wire service or a newspaper or a network, who needs to be the supreme generalist. He is called upon to report stories one day about Russia and missiles, and another day about grain sales, and a third day about political corruption in Kentucky or wherever, and about the president's social life, and about parties, and about golf, and about everything that comes down the pike. It is literally impossible for any man to be uniformly expert in all those various fields that come across the president's desk and consequently get talked about by the press secretary to the press. In my day on the Times, and Ned Deal was there, we used to make quite a point of breaking up, for example, presidential press conferences, having them written in 5 or 6 or 7 different sidebars by various specialists on the staff who went to the press conference. But the one man who was there day and night is under terrific strain, competitive strain, physical strain, and the strain of half the time feeling that he's having to tread water because the subject matter that he's called upon to write about is something he really doesn't know very much about. In the best of all possible worlds, all White House correspondents would be wise philosophers who were knowledgeable about technology, science, the arts, and everything else. But in the real world, they are not. They're very hard-pressed men. And I think from that point of view, they deserve a word of defense.
May I make a comment, too? You raise an awfully good point about the non-sequiturs in White House presidential press conferences in which it seems that a frivolous question is intruded just at the time when the right follow-up question could have really elucidated the point at issue. A lot of us have thought about that problem for many years, and unfortunately it turns out to be one of the world's insoluble problems. If the president can't tell whether the person he recognizes is going to ask the follow-up question, and the person he recognizes has prepared in advance with something that he or she wants and insists on asking, and I'm afraid that non sequitur type of script of scenario is just inevitably with us on a White House a presidential press conference. Now, anybody else on his feet? I've got a nice one here or a pair of them, that I'd like you both to comment on. I'll read them both. One, is the use of the byline helpful or hurtful to better news reporting? The companion question, why has the public been led to believe just because X reporter said so? Should we drop the byline in the newspapers, reduce the ego involvement of reporters, and let the public come to its opinion without knowing who is reporting what? Jim Bellows, star.
Well, of course, the bylines, I think, have increased in all newspapers over the last 20 to 30 years, and you even take Newsweek now that it's bylining most of their stories. And I think time may eventually move a little more in that direction. But I think it's important to somehow identify the people who have written that story where somebody could call them or write them, and it puts somebody on the line a little more than if that story appeared as if it was rewritten from several different reporters. And the rewrite man, of course, is always a face in the crowd, and that's all.
In my days as a very young reporter, and a very underpaid one, it was considered that the byline was in lieu of dollars. Today, when Washington correspondents, I'm told by Jim Bellows, are plutocrats, perhaps that argument doesn't follow, but I think the point Jim has made is really quite important. If you're talking about accountability, which we do talk about a great deal in discussions of public affairs in the United States.
Of credibility?
I think...
Credibility was...
No, accountability.
Accountability.
I think it's quite important to me to know who wrote a particular story, whether it's right or whether it's wrong.
Can I...
By all means.
Elaborate a little on what he was saying about the highest paid journalists here. I think that's part of the trouble that we have, that the journalists today, and I say this is a good thing, don't misunderstand, but it also is a problem for us. We are so well educated, I'm talking about the vast breed of reporters, and so well paid, that I'm not sure that there is that much understanding of the Washington Press Corps with really what the people out in this country want to know about how the cost of government is going up, or what it costs to them, and things like that are far more important than some of the overcovered policy discussions on high.
That's, of course, an issue of what we're covering as distinct from the issue of whether the bylines are good or bad. I'm the only one of the three of us who falls in that category of having a byline. And I think, on the whole, I would agree with both Ellie and Jim that it tends to contribute more toward responsible writing, accountability, than the absence of a byline. But I don't think it makes an enormous amount of difference. If you're a reporter who believes that the first obligation is to get it right, it doesn't make that much difference whether you have a byline or not. Now, anybody else on his feet? Yes?
I'm Laura Kreitz from Washington, Lee. In speaking of the people across the country, traveling through the country this last summer, I found many people with a resentment amounting almost to outrage against the press, canceling their subscriptions to the newspapers, insisting they're not going to listen to television anymore. Is this a consequence of the investigative reporting, do you suppose, or how do you account for this?
Well, that's a little bit of what I was just talking about, but Michael Novak, one of the Harvard scholars, says that when, let's say, one of the Washington reporters goes out to talk to the people in the suburbs as to how they feel about some political campaign or some political issue, that they are looking at that from their own limited perspective within a more affluent elite repertorial crew, and in effect, they are not really reporting how those people feel about the issue. They're reporting what they think those people should feel. And I think that's a real problem. That's part of the communication and understanding gap that I think we've got now that we've got to conquer.
I suspect, if I may just add a thought, that there's another element there. I agree. I've talked with Michael Novak at great length about his theory of elitism. I've had a small debate with Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who wrote an article to the same effect in Commentary some years ago. So it's not a new issue for me, but I think there is one other point, apart from the class thing, the elitist view that perhaps some people out there attribute, above all, to Washington correspondents. And that is the nature of the news in recent years. We've had a great deal of very bad news. It was the truth, but it was a very unpleasant truth. The media were, of course, the people who brought that bad news to people in many parts of the country. And I imagine, although this is hard to prove, that there are people out there across this land with a picture in their mind of America as it used to be and therefore as it ought to be still. And when they look at their television set or at the front page of their paper and see reflected there another kind of picture, picture of ugly, frightened, nasty people doing ugly, frightening, and nasty things to each other, there is a powerful tendency to blame the press and perhaps even to imagine that the press invented that picture, that it is not a real picture of the truth. Now, that is something that I think has been visible for the past 5 or 6 years. It is something that clearly was visible within the White House because I think it was in a conscious effort to manipulate that suspicion that Mr. Agnew was turned loose in 1969.
Jim, you had another comment?
Just one other thing, too. I think that the public would like to know more about how, and this gets into how their dollars are spent, rather than just those high policy issues. I speak specifically about, let's say, the food stamp program. They talked to us the other day about how the quality control had been reduced, improved from 8.4% error to 8.2% error. They will not talk to you about how that means that's a $300 million loss to the taxpayers in this country. But those are the stories that I think that the people want. They don't want to be talked to in general terms about the values of the program. They want to know what is happening to their tax money. And I'm not sure we're doing that good a job in that area.
Let me follow up the question from the floor and ask you both this. Insofar as a credibility problem is the cause of the cancellations of subscriptions and the anger at the press, that is, people just believe they're not getting the truth out of the papers. And given the fact that across the country, most of the news in the papers is in unavoidably wire service news, do you believe a credibility problem, credibility attack is warranted? That is, that people can't believe what they read in the paper.
Are you asking, do we believe that the...
I'm sorry, I put it badly. Do you think people are justified in feeling they're being misled?
Now, Jim, why don't you take that?
Just plain truth and falsehood.
Well, no. I mean, there's no question about it. The only problem is that if you would be able to fill up a newspaper with 500 pages every day, and it might somebody want 300 of those, the other person might want 200 of those, and you've got the problem that I don't care who sees this event, everybody is going to have a different view of it, and yet the one person that is writing it for the newspaper has a view that everybody is going to have a slight difference of opinion with. And that's what I think, as the public is far more better educated today than it was 40, 50 years ago, they are also better able to judge. But they're still not willing to agree that there should be all these different viewpoints.
Ellie?
Well, I would agree, if I understood you correctly, with one point in your question, and that is that the wire services, the Associated Press and the United Press International, in fact supply the bulk of information to most American newspapers.
And to radio and TV stations.
And to radio and TV. In fact, radio and TV would be struck dumb if anybody were to disconnect the AP or UPI machine. So that a great part of the responsibility does reside, it seems to me, with them. Now, I happen to think they do a pretty good job. So that's only half an answer, if you will. But they are under enormous pressure of time, as we all know. There is, I think, still a residue in the thinking of wire service executives and of some newspaper executives who behave as if nothing had changed in the world over the past 50 years. As if the city of New York, for example, still had 11 or 12 or 14 daily newspapers when, in fact, it has 2.5. And there is really very little competition in the press in most major cities. Washington is unique, or close to being unique, in having two very good papers owned separately. In a great many cities, it's a one-ownership situation, with essentially the same paper masquerading under two flags, one in the morning, one in the evening. I think the wires have a very major responsibility here. They provide the raw stuff for just about every news organization. Washington is not typical because the Star and the Post have large staffs and write a great deal of their own material. But that is not true if you travel out across this country, as the lady in question did. You'll find that the wire services are the main source.
Yes, and I would add to that that it's my judgment, after a fairly long time in this business, that the wire services don't always get it right, but they always try to get it right, that they avoid bias about as well as it's humanly possible to do so. I know that I read an AP or UPI story with confidence.
Yeah, just one second.
Yes.
Well, basic one trouble is that there's just too damn much news today.
That's
too
right.
Many little things that are happening all over the world. And we've got too many what I call old green eye shade editors who think that the latest little tidbit has to be jammed into the paper when what the public really wants is an understanding of what's going on, that we're still working to give the public. Yeah.
Here is a classic question that has, I guess, been with us since the beginning of time. And I'll ask Ellie to volunteer first. Can you justify a reporter and his newspaper publishing classified information where, if an ordinary citizen did this, he would be prosecuted?
Yes, I can. I don't find that very difficult to do. A reporter normally gets classified information because somebody in control of that information feels that the public ought to know about it. President Kennedy once said, "The ship of state is the only ship that leaks at the top." That certainly has been my experience. I can remember in my New York Times days, there was a great to-do about something called the Yalta Papers. Well, the Yalta Papers were leaked not by some fourth-rate bureaucrat, but by the Secretary of State, Mr. John Foster Dulles, who handed them to James Reston of the New York Times. That's how major leaks happen most of the time. And to hold a journalist responsible criminally responsible, as the question seems to suggest, for publishing material which most often the public certainly has a right to know about and even a need to know about in some cases, seems to me wrong-headed.
All right.
Now, I'm not obviously talking about the formula for the latest version of the hydrogen bomb. I wouldn't publish that, and I would take a very dim view of anybody else publishing it.
I think we have a question from the floor.
Yes, my name is Anson Carter. I am a retired federal employee. I wonder if it would be too much to expect of the papers, including the absent post editor and the absent TV editors, if their political writers could rise to the same level of accuracy as their sports writers. I'll briefly explain. probably there will be in the Star and Post, and it will be mentioned today, that the magic number of the Red Sox against the Orioles is 5. Any combination of 5 Red Sox wins or 5 Oriole losses will clinch the pennant for Boston. Now, when a question of a veto is up in the Senate, which has 100 members, do you think it would be fair and helpful if each columnist or commentator started his statement? The magic number is 67, which, when Mr. the New Hampshire man is seated, would mean 62 Democratic yeas plus 5 Republican yeas, or any combination thereof, totaling 67. Instead of yelling, why isn't there any leadership in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party?
Well, now that that question, I think, goes to the methods by which we handle, particularly votes in Congress. Jim Bellows?
Well, as far as the news story goes, I think that would be fine for the magic number. But as far as a comment or a political column, I think it would be certainly proper for somebody to making a statement of opinion.
I think there's one additional point. One of the charms of sports writing is, A, that you get a lot more stylistic freedom than you do covering, say, the House of Representatives. The people are more colorful. But even more than that, when you're covering a sports event, it's a finite event. There's a final score. It ends at some point, even if it's delayed. You know who won and who lost by how much. That is not the case, need I say, in reporting political, economic, and social affairs in a capital like this one, where all you can do is day by day report that day's installment without frequently knowing where it's going to come out 3 months or 6 months from now.
I'd like to make a comment myself on that. I think there's a certain amount of what you suggest going on. I recall, for example, in the days before the recent Senate vote to sustain the president's veto of the oil price decontrol, several stories that practically went down the whole list, or at least all the list of the wavering senators, to assess what the outcome might be, and every one of them said that the magic number is 67. Question for Ellie Abel. I would appreciate your comments on the Joseph McCarthy era, during which time people were condemned by irresponsible headlines in the press.
Well, it's a subject that I guess the older ones among us are all too dismally familiar with. I was in Washington part of that time, but I was a very new boy here. I do remember the fear and the anxiety and the ugliness that ran through parts of this town at the time, and the country as a whole. I think the press, or a segment of the press, played right into McCarthy's hands by not asking those questions that I mentioned in my opening remarks. From the very beginning, when he got up there and waved what seems to have been a blank piece of paper and said he held in his hand the names of X hundreds of communists or communist sympathizers in the State Department, there were reporters present on a number of those occasions. They fell victim, I think, to their own training, which was that objectivity as defined by them was report what the man said. Maybe the truth will catch up with it later. It wasn't that those reporters believed implicitly everything that McCarthy said. And I know several of them, still around, now retired for the most part, who tried very hard to get at the truth of some of these things without signal success. McCarthy was very clever in sidestepping that kind of inquiry. But I would agree, it wasn't just the headlines. It was kind of the deadpan reporting of malicious inaccuracies and inventions, as if there was at least a fighting chance that they might be the truth, that gave McCarthy his power. And once that power began to be manifest, it was perfectly clear that even the potentates on the Hill were afraid to tangle with him. And it wasn't till very much later that a couple of fairly obscure members of the Senate decided that decency had been outraged sufficiently, and by gosh, they were going to do something about it. But it took a long time, a very shabby episode.
I'd like to say, make one thing perfectly clear, that this is an imperfect craft. And that's, you look back on the Nixon era, and you remember how the press really, over a number of years, took all the Nixon statements at face value. And it wasn't until very, very late when the press finally swung around in pretty good shape and tried to straighten things out. But that's why I think also that we have a number of people that say that the press is trying to tear down the country. Well, I think that if the press had done the right job during the McCarthy era, we wouldn't have had McCarthyism to that extent. I think if they'd done the right job during the early years of Nixon, we would not have had the Watergate that we did have.
Just a brief additional comment about the problems we face. The kind of thing I have in mind is not anything that's going to smear individuals, but each day we face the problem of a senator or a representative, or in some case a representative of the executive branch, making a statement, I know of many in my own economic area, that we just know are outrageously wrong, just factually wrong on the gasoline price or whatever. And we have the real problem of whether to use it. After all, he's responsible for it. Possibly even make a headline out of it. We don't write the headline, of course, but we write the lead on which the headline is based. It's a terribly difficult problem to know what is responsible in that situation. Now, our first solid question on the the other media, the radio and TV, a very broad one. Since a large majority of persons receive most of their information concerning domestic and international news via the electronic media, do you think adequate in-depth information is provided by the media to give the viewer a balanced objective viewpoint about events? Or is the viewer getting a very spotty, slanted, emotional report? Ellie, you start on that one.
My problem with radio and TV as a source of information is not its emotionalism. I find remarkably little of that. It is the enforced brevity. I think David Brinkley once said this openly, that anybody who had to subsist on an information diet limited to what the networks put out was bound to die of intellectual malnutrition. That was true when he said it. It is true today, in my view. The half-hour evening news shows on the networks are, in fact, 22 or 23 minutes long because of the need to pay the bill by filling them up with patent medicine commercials of the kind the FTC should have ruled off the air many, many years ago.
Jim.
And those 22 minutes amount to something like less than two columns of newspaper type. Now, any newspaper that tried to tell you everything you needed to know about what went on in the world in two columns wouldn't survive very long. However, we are a people who like to eat on the run. We eat badly, in consequence. We like to get informed on the run. We don't want to waste too much time getting involved in technicalities, and what we get is processed news. I wish it were otherwise, but I would have to submit to you that the American public seems to be perfectly content for the most part with what it gets, and that is the most pessimistic thing I'll have to say today.
Well, I'm very thankful that radio and TV can't do the job of helping the public to understand that. But I do think that that radio and TV do whet the appetite of an educated public to understand more of what's going on. And the right, good job done by newspapers, I think, will perform a function for a long, long time to come.
This is a local question for Mr. Bellows. How do you apportion your space? We made a study last year and affirmed that the local Virginia elections received less coverage than Maryland and the district.
Ah.
That's a bit of chauvinism.
Just hand yourself.
Well, that was my day off. I was in Los Angeles. But I hope it doesn't happen again. It shouldn't.
Anybody on us? Yes.
My name is William Jellin, and I'm a graduate student at Georgetown University, and I have a question for Mr. Abel. And we've discussed this a little bit before, but the focus of your remarks, I sense, was about herd journalism, and I wish you would enumerate some of the specific and most insidious causes and effects of herd journalism, and maybe you could suggest an antidote.
Well, if I could suggest an answer, I would have patented it and become a millionaire long since. The herd instinct, in essence, leads one reporter or news organization to think that whatever another reporter or news organization came up with first is the story. And so you go along and do the same story on the same assumptions without asking any additional questions or without perhaps trying to plow a separate furrow in another direction. It is, I think, a tendency that is reinforced by editors, unfortunately. Jim may not agree with me, but I think the definition of what is news comes basically from the editor and the character who decides the character of the newspaper down to the reporter. And the reporter, in consequence, feels that he, you know, he's representing a paper with a certain range of interests, and he goes along. But herd instinct is the kind of thing I had years ago when I was working for a Detroit newspaper here in Washington. And Caroline Kennedy fell into a swimming pool. It was not a matter of major concern to me, nor indeed should it have been to my editor. But my editor called the minute that story moved on the UPI and said, "What have you done about it?" And I said, "Well, you're going to press in 10 minutes, and the UPI story is there, and I've seen it. As far as I know, it's accurate. Why don't you print it?" He said, no, we want it from you. That's herd journalism, or one aspect of it, where you are encouraged to waste a hell of a lot of time repeating what somebody else has already done. And it's a maddening business.
I think we have time for only one or two more questions. Anybody on his feet down here?
Yes, I'm down here. My name is Flora Cohen, and I'm from Washington, D.C. here. Is it not a fact that the press many times is guilty of slanted reporting on issues or questions with which it is not in sympathy? I ask this question from a background of involvement with the Respect for Life movement, which, like the movement of the American Indian, is often not reported objectively or fairly, and is many times played down, such as the great demonstrations that have been held the last 2 years at the Capitol on January 22nd with regard to the Respect for Life movement, which was a commemoration of the January 22nd Supreme Court decision on the liberalization of abortion.
I'm afraid you better hurry up the question, ma'am.
Yes, well, that in essence is, you know what I mean.
Jim Bellows, you understand?
I certainly think it's an imperfect craft, as I mentioned, but I also think that, let's say you go back to the student rebellion days and so forth, and if you printed all those pictures, people would complain because the other people weren't marching. Now, if you've got 20 marches by the Right to Life group and you don't have any marches by the other, I don't think you should put 20 pictures of the Right to Life march in there. But I think that newspapers generally, in all the issues like that, try to do both sides, but it's an imperfect craft.
Anybody else? All right. I'll ask one last, very brief one here. How much does the White House, Congress, or the courts attempt to influence what the press covers, and to what extent, and how successful are they? I can testify to personal experience. They try very hard. The question of how successful they are, perhaps more successful than they ought to be, just because they're very important people, it's pretty hard to avoid writing their speeches, their viewpoints, their handouts.
I have to agree with you, Ed. The White House, certainly in my day, tried very, very hard indeed to set the news agenda. And that was regardless of who the president was or what party he belonged to. And I think that's the great virtue, the great value of incumbency.
Now, very, very seldom in corrupt ways. It's just pressure that they would like to get their story told.
Well, thank you for being a good and interested and inquisitive audience. That will end this week's town meeting. The next week's will be again here in the Eisenhower Theater at 10:30, and the topic will be, when should America use nuclear weapons? With Representative Patricia Schroeder of Colorado and Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, the former Chief of Naval Operation, with Helen Thomas of the UPI as moderator. Thank you.
Thus, the conclusion of this national town meeting, the topic of which was appraising the Washington Press Corps. The principal speakers were Ellie Abel, former Washington correspondent and now dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism, and James Bellows, editor of the Washington Star. The moderator was Edwin Dale of the New York Times. From the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, this is Josh Darsa speaking. Technical director for this broadcast.